Welcome to HN Pod, your daily deep dive into the top stories and discussions from Hacker News. I am Sarah.
And I am Mike. Today is Tuesday, March 17th, 2026, and we are bringing you episode 337. We have got a really fascinating lineup covering the top stories from yesterday, March 16th.
We really do. We are going to be talking about a wild story where Polymarket gamblers are actually threatening a journalist over a missile strike report. Then we have a heavy but important piece of reporting from the BBC about a tragic incident in the West Bank. After that, we will look at some new political science research on why corruption destroys trust in democracies faster than in autocracies.
We will also be digging into some serious warnings from UK Ministry of Defense insiders about Palantir. And we will wrap up on a lighter, builder-focused note with a great blog post on how software engineering is evolving with the latest LLMs like Opus 4.6.
Let us jump right into that first story. It hit over 1,300 points yesterday. The headline is, Polymarket gamblers threaten to kill me over Iran missile story, published in the Times of Israel.
This is one of those stories that perfectly encapsulates the weird cyberpunk reality we are living in right now. Emmanuel Fabian, who is the military correspondent for the Times of Israel, wrote what he thought was a standard report on March 10th. He reported that an Iranian ballistic missile had struck an open area near Beit Shemesh. No injuries, just a massive explosion from the warhead.
Right. But then his inbox starts blowing up. He gets these emails in Hebrew from random people, begging and then demanding and then outright threatening him to change his reporting. They wanted him to edit the article to say it was just interceptor debris, not a full missile impact.
And he is sitting there wondering why these people care so deeply about this specific, relatively minor semantic detail. And then he checks X, formerly Twitter, and realizes these people are gamblers on Polymarket. They had bet on a market titled Iran Strikes Israel on and the date.
And the fine print of that market is wild. It says the market resolves to yes if a missile lands, but it resolves to no if the missile is intercepted, regardless of the damage. There was over $14 million riding on this specific date. So these gamblers who bet no were literally trying to intimidate a war reporter into changing reality so their crypto bets would pay out.
The Hacker News comments on this were intense. A lot of people were comparing prediction markets to sports betting, but pointing out the massive difference in the blast radius. User Margola Bargola made the point that people have been throwing sports matches for a century, but when you apply that same financial incentive to global geopolitics, it gets incredibly dangerous.
Exactly. If you bet on a team losing, maybe you bribe the goalie. If you bet on a company failing, maybe you call in a bomb threat to their headquarters. And if you bet on a missile strike, you harass the journalist reporting the facts.
What I found really interesting in the comments was the discussion around regulation. User LFNerd pointed out that technically, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission in the US prohibits contracts on terrorism, assassination, and war. But platforms like Polymarket and Kalshi have successfully lobbied to classify these as democratized futures. It is a massive loophole kept open by Silicon Valley lobbying money, and now we are seeing the real-world consequences of financializing literal acts of war.
It really is a dangerous precedent. Speaking of the real-world consequences of conflict, our next story is a very heavy one from the BBC. The headline is, Palestinian boy, 12, describes how Israeli forces killed his family and car. It reached nearly 1,000 points on Hacker News yesterday.
It is a heartbreaking piece of reporting. The BBC spoke with a 12-year-old boy named Khalid, who survived a shooting in the West Bank village of Timun. His family was driving home late at night after shopping for the Eid holiday. His parents and two younger brothers, including his 7-year-old who was blind and disabled, were killed when Israeli forces opened fire on their car.
The Israeli army stated that the car accelerated toward their forces and they responded to the perceived danger, but the BBC interviewed a local resident who witnessed the event and said the car had come to a complete halt before any shots were fired, with no warning given. First responders also noted that the sheer volume of fire directed at the vehicle was highly unusual.
The Hacker News community had a very sobering discussion about this. A lot of the conversation zoomed out to look at the systemic issues of how armed forces and police operate. User Weekend drew a parallel to American policing, specifically the concept of warrior policing.
Yes, that comment really resonated. They talked about how when security forces are trained to operate in a state of constant fear, they perceive absolutely everything as a deadly threat that needs to be neutralized immediately. Whether it is a child throwing a stone or a car that might be driving too fast, the threshold for deploying lethal force drops to almost zero.
Another user, Ryan Drake, expanded on that, pointing out how the phrase, "I felt unsafe," has become this ultimate shield to avoid responsibility. It is used in everything from minor civilian disputes all the way up to justifying military violence. When feeling unsafe is all the justification you need, it creates a culture of immediate, unjustified escalation. It is a grim reality, but it is important that the Hacker News community engages with these global issues, not just the tech news.
I completely agree. And our next story actually bridges the gap between human behavior and societal structures. It is a research paper published in Frontiers in Political Science titled "Corruption Erodes Social Trust More in Democracies Than in Autocracies."
This is fascinating. The researchers looked at data from 62 countries and found that while corruption exists everywhere, it destroys the social fabric much faster in a democracy. They propose two main psychological mechanisms for why this happens.
The first one is normative amplification. In a democracy, the foundational promise is equality and fairness. So when corruption happens, it feels like a massive betrayal of the social contract. It signals that the whole system is rotting. But in an autocracy, the system is already based on inequality. Corruption does not shock anyone because it is just how the system is expected to work.
The second mechanism is representative contagion. In a democracy, the corrupt officials were elected by the people. So if the leaders are corrupt, it casts a shadow on the citizens who put them there, which lowers trust between everyday people. In an autocracy, the elites are seen as the separate, untouchable class. What they do does not necessarily reflect on your neighbor.
The Hacker News comments added so much great context to this. User Yason explained that in authoritarian regimes, corruption is actually a necessary element to keep society functioning. It is the operating system. If you try to do things by the book in a highly corrupt society, you just won't get anywhere.
Right, and user B. Tilly brought up the Russian concept of blot. Blot is not just handing a cop a $20 bill. It's this intricate personal trust network of trading favors. The plumber fixes your sink for free, and in exchange, because you work at the grocery store, you set aside some good cheese for him. In a weird way, participating in that low-level corruption actually builds interpersonal trust within your local network, even though it bypasses the official rules.
It is such a stark contrast to Western democracies, where everyday citizens rarely pay bribes, but the corruption happens at the very top, through lobbying and regulatory capture. It really makes you think about how fragile trust is when our institutions fail to live up to their own stated ideals.
Speaking of fragile trust in institutions, that leads us perfectly into our fourth story. The headline is, "Mod Sources Warn Palantir Role at Heart of Government is Threat to UK Security." This was published by The Nerd and got over 600 points.
Palantir has been deeply embedded in the UK government for years, with hundreds of millions of pounds in contracts across health, defence, and infrastructure. The Ministry of Defence has continually assured the public that all data remains sovereign and under UK ownership. But two anonymous senior systems engineers within the MOD are blowing the whistle, saying that defense is completely missing the point of how Palantir's technology actually works.
Exactly. The whistleblowers explain that Palantir does not need to own the raw data. The danger is in the metadata and the aggregation. One source gave a chilling hypothetical example. Imagine a parcel is sent by a defense supplier. The part number, the destination of Diego Garcia, and the arrival date of April 4th are all completely unclassified pieces of data on their own. But when Palantir's AI aggregates them, it suddenly reveals the highly classified location of a nuclear submarine.
And because Palantir has access to data across the entire UK government, from the NHS to the power grids to the military, they can build a mosaic of the UK that is incredibly detailed. The insiders are warning that giving a single foreign entity, even an American one, this level of pervasive access gives them massive geopolitical leverage.
Hacker News users were definitely not surprised by this. User S. Schuller pointed out that the Swiss military recently rejected Palantir for this exact reason. They looked at the tech and realized the risk of US intelligence backdoors was just too high.
There was also a lot of discussion about Peter Thiel and Alex Karp, the founders of Palantir. User Matrix Man pointed out the irony of the company's name. In Lord of the Rings, a Palantir is a seeing stone that ultimately corrupts the user and deceives them. It is wild that a surveillance company chose that name, and even wilder that governments keep buying it despite the obvious lock-in and security risks.
It really highlights the danger of states losing their sovereign tech capabilities and having to outsource their brains to private Silicon Valley firms.
Let us pivot to our final story, which is much more hands-on for the developers in the audience. It is a blog post by Stavros Korokithakis titled, How I Write Software with LLMs.
I loved this post. Stavros starts with a confession. He says, I do not care for the joy of programming. I just like making things. And with the recent leap in models like Opus 4.6 and Codex 5.2, he has been building massive, complex projects without actually writing the code himself.
He has built some really fun stuff. He made a personal assistant called Stavrobot that manages his calendar and chores. He made a physical pendant that records voice notes and sends them to his AI. He even made Pinetown, which is this whimsical, infinite multiplayer canvas where people can draw together.
The core of his post is about how the skill set of a software engineer is shifting. He says he no longer needs to know syntax or how to write a function perfectly. What matters now is system architecture. If you do not understand how to architect a system, the LLM will quickly turn your code base into an unmaintainable mess. But if you guide the architecture, you can fill tens of thousands of lines of code with a near zero defect rate.
He uses a harness tool called OpenCode to manage this, but the Hacker News comments sparked a huge debate about the best way to interact with these new models. Stavros uses a multi-agent approach, where he has one AI act as the architect, another as the developer, and a third as the reviewer.
Yeah, but user Akril1996 pushed back on that hard. They said that in their experience running production agents, the whole architect-to-developer pipeline is just theater. If you give a model like Opus good context and clear direction in a single prompt, the output is already solid.
User Arialdo Martini actually ran an experiment with their colleagues to test this. They set up a complex council of agents with different personas, business analyst, security expert, developer, and it cost them about $12 in API calls to get a good result. Then they gave the exact same prompt to a single model, Claude Code, using Haiku, and it got the same result for 30 cents.
It is a profound realization. Humans use job separation because our brains have limited capacity. I cannot be a world-class security expert and a front-end developer at the same time, but an LLM has all of that in its weights already. When you force AI to use human organizational structures, you are just introducing communication overhead and bureaucracy for no reason.
That is such a great insight. It makes you wonder how many of our current AI workflows are just us projecting human limitations onto a totally different type of intelligence. I am sure we will see these tools evolve even more over the next few months.
Absolutely. Well, that covers it for today. From the dangerous real-world impacts of prediction markets and global conflicts, to the shifting nature of trust, government surveillance, and the future of coding.
Thanks so much for listening to HN Pod. We will be back tomorrow with more of the top stories from Hacker News. Have a great day and keep building.